Welcome back, everyone, to the 64th episode of Through the Aftermath. I am your host, Sean, and I'm not joined by Jonathan this time because I decided to do this this kind of impromptu interview. And this is with Jim Tank Dorsey, who you may remember we've had on the show before. He plays Lord Humongous. He was on the show back in 2015. I think it was about February 2015, episode 53. So if you check that one out, that was our first interview with him. And this one is all about a documentary that's being made about him by Faye Merman. And she's on the show too. This interview is with both of them. And Faye, it's kind of a, I think it's an interesting story. She interviewed him for a TV, she worked for a TV station in New York, and she interviewed him at one point. She was so fascinated by him, his life, and everything he does with Mad Max cosplay, and she decided to quit her job and follow him around the world to make this documentary. They've been doing it for about almost a year. I think in June it'll be a year. I think it's a fascinating story. You know, I had to get him on the show. He's a friend of ours, and he's just he's such a fascinating guy. And this, the fact that there's a documentary being made about him, I mean, you can't get any better than that. So I got him on the show, and the documentary is called Humongous, : a documentary. But there's more information in the interview about when it should be finished, because right now it's not even really completed filming 100%. I think she's going to finish up at Wasteland Weekend this year in September, and then it goes into the editing process. So it's a pretty exciting idea, I think. So I'm really happy to have them on the show, and I hope you all enjoy. Remember, if you want to contact us and stay in contact with us, it's our Facebook page is probably your best bet, and also that will be linked in the show notes, and also there's our email at ttaftermath@gmail.com. Here you go. Here's the interview with Jim Tank Dorsey and Faye Merman. All right. I am here joined by Mr. Jim the Tank Dorsey. How are you doing, Jim?
Awesome.
And also we have Faye Merman, who is doing the documentary. How are you doing, Faye?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think it's a good opportunity to kind of get you both on the show and talk about, you know, what this documentary is all about. And not only that, but, you know, you guys have had just a whirlwind experience, I imagine, just going through the filming of the documentary. And it's just been years now, right? Hasn't it been like probably 2 years?
It feels like decades.
Actually, we're just coming up on a year in June. It'll be a
year. Okay. It just seems
like
2 years.
This whole conversation, because I'd like to know what the hell this documentary is all about. This would be enlightening.
That's very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the thing is, it's been, you know, time flies, I guess, when you're my age. But the last time we had you on the show, Tank, it was February of 2015.
Yeah.
And that was quite a while. I mean, that was 2 years ago. So mm-hmm. What have you been up to since then?
A lot of no good, really. No. More of the same. I mean, my big events that I do every year, Wasteland Weekend, Dragon Con, a couple of Comic Cons, local conventions, that sort of thing. Still doing weddings. I just married my mother. I just officiated the wedding between my mother and her fiance back in December. So that was a bit of an honor. She didn't want me to do it as Lord Humongous, though, which kind of threw me.
I was just going to ask that.
She said, I just want you to be Jim. And I was like, I don't know how to do that, Mom. You ought to give me something else to go by. So she at least let me dress up in a suit of armor, and that was cool enough.
Nice.
Oddly enough, the DJ thing, the whole DJ Humongous thing that started off as a goof, just some silly idea that I ran past one of the Wasteland Weekend event organizers, has like really caught on. It's the one thing I actually make money doing. So I DJ up in Yonkers, New York, and Newark, New Jersey. There's a big club there that keeps having me back. I unveiled DJ Drago recently for a Soviet themed Cold War night sort of party we had. That was kind of fun and interesting.
Nice.
And you know, of course, the usual, you know, a couple costumes here, a couple costumes there, but mostly this documentary has been occupying all of my free time, it seems.
Yeah, so why don't you tell me a little bit about what this documentary is all about? I mean, like you said, it, you know, it's been a year. You have to have some good stories from this, and you've got to have just some, you know, I mean, there has to be something that has been just the most overwhelming part of, and in a good way, of filming this documentary so far. So just tell us what it's about and kind of your favorite parts.
It's hard to pick a favorite part, but in a nutshell, what this documentary is about, it's about the world of Mad Max cosplay, which I didn't know existed until this. I started this documentary. It's about a global group of friends who are just so enthusiastic about this really specific thing, and it's told through the eyes, through the point of view of Tank, who I would think that most people would agree with is the leader of this group, or maybe one of the leaders of this group.
The cult leader, yeah.
So he's the focal point, but it's about this broader story about this global family that no matter where you go in the world, the same people come from all four corners to get together and celebrate Mad Max or cosplay or post-apocalyptic cosplay. So I find it fascinating. And when I say family, I mean family. I never saw a group of friends who lived so far apart be so close and so well gelled together. Yet overwhelming was a good word. A lot of this documentary is overwhelming. I've never made a feature-length documentary before. I'm just doing this trial by fire. So overwhelming bad would be, gosh, I never had to carry so much gear for 17, 20 hours a day all by myself in my life.
Put up with the prima donna.
Put up with the drama queen.
Seriously.
But the overwhelming and a good thing, I can't tell you how many times I've just been looking through the viewfinder of my camera and been like, oh God, this is it. This is great. But one story in particular actually happened very recently. We were in Australia. We were in the outback visiting the Pinnacles, which is where in the Road Warrior, the compound is. And, you know, Humongous comes and he wants to break into the compound and get the gasoline. We climbed up the mountain and Tank, of course, was dressed as Humongous. And our friend Steve was there with Max and we had a lot of people dressed up. It was really cool. And we climb the top of this mountain, and I have Tank kind of posing for me on a ledge, and I'm down below shooting up. And then I say, hold on, wait a minute, let me come up there with you. And I come and I stand behind him, and you could see in front of him this just vast desert, and you could see the spot where the compound was. You could still see the scar in the earth where they blew it up, and there Tank was in all his glory, dressed up as Humongous, just living this moment, this just reveling in this moment, and his back was to the camera, and I'm not gonna lie, my eyes filled up with tears because in that moment I knew I had the closing shot of the documentary. And it was bittersweet because that kind of put some sense of finality to the whole project, even though we still have quite a ways to go. But I knew in my gut in that moment that I found the closing shot, and that was something pretty special.
One of the things I found kind of haunting about that moment was, you know, you were filming, so everybody's being quiet, and all I could hear was the wind blowing, and it just kind of added to the solitude of where we were in the middle of the outback, a sacred actual Aboriginal land. We had to get permission to go on there.
Mm-hmm.
Very powerful stuff. And of course, I'm standing on the edge, you know, one more step, and I'm dying. I'm going down this mountain in a bad way. But yeah, I remember when you called cut and I turned around to see how, you know, how we were doing, the look on your face was like, oh my God, are you okay? So yeah, that was pretty charged emotionally. I had also from the Australia trip recently, kind of a funny moment. We were out in the outskirts of Melbourne where Goose did his morning ride before he crashes. And I was kind of recreating, I got dressed up in my Jim Goose gear, and we were kind of recreating the scene after the accident, sans a motorcycle, unfortunately. But there's the time when he stands up and says, you know, MFP copy, MFP copy, hey, 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 it's the Goose. So cameras are rolling, I'm there delivering my line, and just without even thinking about it, I go, hey, 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 it's the Tank. And I think the onlookers were like, that was intentional, right? I'm like, believe it or not, no, it wasn't. Just cut and do it again. My bad. So, that was fun. It was hot.
That was a good one. Oh, it was disgusting.
Oh, my God.
So hot.
Black leather.
Now, Faye, you mentioned that this is your first documentary. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your experience and I guess mainly, you know, how this project has changed your life?
Sure. Well, honestly, and Tank and I were talking about this not that long ago, this has changed my life in every facet imaginable and all for the better, I'd say. But I'm a photojournalist. I've been a photojournalist for the last 10 years. I actually got my start in newspapers as a still photographer in Philly and eventually moved up to New York. And, you know, eventually photos just kind of weren't lucrative. You couldn't really keep a job as a still photog. So I learned video. And from video, I ended up at a television station, which I never thought I'd be at. And one day on an assignment last June, my station sent me to a museum on Long Island to do a media preview day for a con out there. And I interviewed Tank dressed as Lord Humongous. And believe it or not, I didn't know who he was dressed as. I wasn't that steeped in Mad Max culture. And so my first question was, who the hell are you and why are you naked? And then, you know, I asked him the standard questions for the news, and he made the news that night on my station. And then I put the camera down and I started talking to him, and I just was fascinated that this big guy who's dressed as this big, scary bad guy, just in his downtime, he's sewing his own costumes, and not just for him, but for his whole family. And I thought that that was just so cool. And I thought right in that moment, I could just see how multidimensional Tank was and how interesting he would be to make a little project on. So at first I thought I'd come up for a weekend and make a 3-minute video on him, which is the funniest thing I ever said, it turns out. Because it couldn't be further from the truth. We started talking about his schedule, and he started telling me about Dragon Con and Wasteland Weekend and Australia. And I said, oh, my God, like this is so much bigger than I ever thought it would be. So I just kind of been sticking it out for the long haul here, just following you wherever you go, because it just gets more interesting as we keep going and more visual. And I think my shooting is getting stronger, too. I think I finally found the visual voice of this movie. I think I've got the way I want to shoot this movie down. And yeah, it's been a learning experience, and it's been nothing but fabulous. But to do all that traveling with Tank, I actually had to make a choice. I had to quit my job at my television station in New York, and I did it with no hesitation. Making a movie is something I always wanted to do, and I was always really worried it would be a pipe dream for me. So this project seemed like the perfect opportunity, because you come across a lot of people as a journalist, especially in 10 years, that seem like they're good material to do a long form story on, but they don't call you back, or they chicken out, or they flake out, or it just doesn't work out. Something goes wrong. I knew that Tank was just as dedicated to this project as me. And that gave me enough confidence to jump ship and to say, you know, a corny cliche, follow my dream. Television was great, but it wasn't what I wanted to do, but making movies is, so I'm giving it a shot.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a dedication, you know, but you're right. I mean, Tank has that about him where you just want to follow him, you know, you believe in him, and you know that he puts 200% in everything he does. So yeah, I completely see what you're talking about. And, you know, speaking of that, I mean, you guys just got back from Australia, like you mentioned, and I kind of watched from the Facebook sidelines and you know, watched these videos that were being, or the pictures that were being posted up, just incredible stuff. Can you tell me about even just a rundown of how that trip went?
Yeah, well, it was about a month that we were there, but we kind of broke it up into 1-week sections. The first week we were in and around Melbourne. With the help from my good friend Dale Bench, whom we call Donut Dale. He does the burnout circle in the old town, Clunes, in Mad Max. He's the one that was rumored to have died during the filming of Mad Max, because he gets hit in the back of the head with a motorcycle as he's sliding across the street on a bridge. It just looked really rough in slow motion, but he was fine.
He's good.
Yeah, he's good. He's a little, little knocked around up there, but he's good. Anyway, he gave us his GPS. He put together this booklet of day by day, location by location, like the order that we should go see things in. And I had done this with him like 4 years ago, but I now had a new crew with me and wanted to show them around, wanted to film some things I wasn't able to last time due to a knee injury. So we went to places like Emu Creek Bridge, which is where the the Mad Max finishes, where Johnny the Boy's, you know, handcuffed to or ankle cuffed, I guess in this case, to a truck, and Max drives away as the truck blows up. Again, we went to Clunes, which is where the central garage is, the town where the biker gang rolls in and they terrorize the place. Faye actually conducted an interview with Dale there, with his activity being a stunt driver and one of the extras in the biker gang in Mad Max. We went to the Melbourne University garage, which as soon as you drive in there and you see these pillars, the way that they're shaped, right away you recognize it as the MFP garage, where the Interceptor is first introduced. Mm-hmm. And we got there late at night. It was like after midnight. So there was like a nice unparked in section that we were able to take some photos in. That was really cool. Went to Kirk's Bridge, which is the bridge where Dale gets hit in the back of the head with the motorcycle. Just up the street from that is where the movie starts, where Max is tuning the Interceptor. We, like I said before, we did Goose's Morning Run, kind of recreated the aftermath of that. We drove by where Sugartown was, that little cabaret that the Goose was hanging out in. Looks nothing like it anymore. Like, you wouldn't even recognize it, sadly. Yeah. The same thing with the Halls of Justice is different. We went to where Goose hands the guy get out of jail free card. That chimney in the background is still there. But the coolest thing that we got to do, which the last time I went there, I wasn't able to get inside. I wasn't able to get into inside the gates. It's a place called the Pumping Station, which is the MFP headquarters. We went there Friday morning just before we were supposed to fly out. So it was like kind of a last minute hurry up and do this thing. We not only got inside the gates, we got inside one of the buildings and got to walk up the stairs into like what would be Fifi's quarters up at the top. And, you know, it's so simple. It was just amazing. It was absolutely amazing for a diehard fan like myself. So that was basically our Melbourne. It was 4 days of just nonstop Mad Max locations.
Oh my God. It was like sun up to midnight, no food, no bathroom breaks.
Yeah. Well, that's the tank schedule.
It was a bit intense, but after that we flew up to Broken Hill, which is about half an hour outside of Silverton in the outback. Broken Hill has a big part in the major part in Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. That is where the movie premiered. It is where it was filmed. It's where the cast and crew lived while it was filming. So it was pretty cool to be there. What I found the most fascinating thing to be about being in Broken Hill is that no matter where you went, everybody had a Mad Max story. Oh, my brother nailed the wood together. Oh, my sister was the paramedic on staff. Like, everybody had a story. And some of them were even more specific than that. We went to a bar one night with a bunch of bikies, a biker gang that was in town. And it was a big Mad Max theme party, of course. And we ran into, this guy was like, oh, yeah, I was a stunt driver. You know, and there was another night we were having dinner and there was a cover band playing. And our friend who was hosting us in Broken Hill said that guy was a stunt driver and an extra in Mad Max 2. Like, everywhere you went, somebody was in Mad Max 2 or had been employed by Mad Max 2 or touched in some way, played a part in Mad Max 2. And I thought that was fascinating. I started interviewing people left and right. I mean, it was like fish in a barrel finding people with Mad Max 2 stories. It was fascinating. We also had the extreme pleasure of meeting Adrian Bennett. Well, Tank had met him before, but it was my first time meeting him. This man moved his whole family, his wife and kids, from the UK to Silverton to open up a Mad Max museum. Talk about great leaps and having faith and following your dreams. I mean, Adrian was fantastic, and his museum is incredible. The stuff that he has, there's actually a documentary being made about him too, Archaeologist of the Wasteland, which I can't promote enough. From what I've seen, it's phenomenal. Just a fascinating man. We had a 4-hour interview,
yeah,
and it was delightful. It felt like 15 minutes. we can't thank Adrian enough for playing a huge part in our movie, and I admire him so much. Other than that, we visited some Mad Max 2 filming locations. The Mundi Mundi Mound, where the movie opens with Wes doing the wheelie on the bike, and where it ends with the car chase and the humongous machine getting, you know, smashed to smithereens. That's all right there on that little stretch of road. So just to be there was something to behold. To me as a photographer, it looked like being on a different planet. The red earth and the sun was so bright, and which I'm blaming on the whole ozone layer.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it just looked like you were on Mars. It just didn't feel like you were anywhere on Earth. It was a really magical place that still looks exactly the same.
Yeah, 35 years later, it's identical. Unlike, you know, Mad Max 1, which was filmed near civilization, some of the things are the same, but some of them are very different. Everything for Mad Max 2 is just as it was 35 years ago. In fact, you go out to the Pinnacles, you can still find pieces of compound kind of scattered out in the dirt. So yeah, and we got treated like a little bit of celebrity while we were in Silverton. We made the newspaper twice. We got on the radio twice. We were on the evening news one night. So it's the Silverton Collective that they host down there. And I got to give a shout out to Steve Schultz for doing a great job this year, organizing it and decorating the youth camp for it and herding all these cats together to make it happen. You know, we got some pretty decent exposure. But that was, that was a week basically in the outback. Then we did a week in Sydney of just the normal person sightseeing, nothing Mad Max related, save for the fact that we did invite Shel Nilsson, the original Lord Humongous, to come join us for the 3-4 days that we were there to do sightseeing with us and just hang out with us. And he was down for it, but unfortunately, like the night before he was supposed to head out, he had a bit of a medical emergency and wasn't able to make it.
Oh.
We'd invited Emil Minty's family, the Feral Child's family, out to dinner with us one night, and sort of the same thing, another medical issue had come up that prevented them from joining us, but you know, they were there. I even spoke with Bruce Spence about maybe meeting up for some dinner and drinks, and he said, oh man, I'm doing a show in Adelaide, so you know, unless you're able to make it out there. Like, oh man, my timing's just just rough here. But we did have a really kind of off the wall experience. We did the Sydney Harbour Bridge climb, and we already had tickets for Shell for all the stuff that we did, so we had to go and, you know, get refunds here and there as we were able to. So when we walked in to the bridge climb, I'm speaking to this guy, you know, Michael, behind the counter, and I tell him, yeah, we're gonna need to get a refund for Mr. Shel Nilsson. He wasn't able to make it, and he looked at me, he's like, Shel Nilsson from Mad Max 2? And I'm like, whoa, you know him? He's like, of course I know him. I was like, wow, all right, I got to get a picture with this guy. This guy's great. And I'm like his biggest fan. So, you know, that was just not something we expected. You know, and after again about a week in Sydney, we took a quick ride up Central Coast into the beach area. Got to see the most amazing private Mad Max collection. Just wow, I was blown away by everything that I saw there, and something rather cool happened while we were there.
Yeah, while we were sitting at this man's kitchen table, it was a very muggy, rainy afternoon, so the front door was open, and I can see through the house to the front door, and I see a man approaching. And it just looked like an older man. And I said to the woman, I said, I think somebody's at your door. And she got up and opened the door. And when he walked in, I looked at Tank and I said, oh my God, it's the toe cutter. Hugh Keith's bird had just walked in to the house. You know, the toe cutter, a Morton Joe, just walked into the house. And he sat down next to us and just had tea and Tim Tams and and just hung out with us and just talked with us, and it was incredible, and I was terrified and amazed, and I just could not believe that I was filming Hugh Keith Burns, and that Hugh Keith Burns, and along with now Vernon Wells, Emil Minty, Shel Nilsson, Virginia Hay, all of these people are in Bruce Spence, all of these people are in my documentary. I can't believe that. It's amazing.
Yeah.
With all those people, was any of that planned, or did it just kind of happen while you were there?
Now, Hugh was a surprise. That was planned by the man we were visiting as a surprise. He's friends with him. But everybody else was just luck and determination. There was an event called WinterCon in Queens in December, and that's where... Now, I had interviewed Vernon, who played Wes, prior to that at Wasteland Weekend. So this was my second time interviewing and filming with Vernon, who is delightful, and I love him. But I got to meet Bruce, Virginia, and Shell at this con too, and I got interviews with everybody and footage. And this is actually the first time that this, and Emil, of course, that this cast had been together in 35 years. This was the first time some of these people were seeing Emil as an adult. And it was pretty fascinating and really special. And I was so proud and happy that I was lucky enough to be there to capture it for my documentary. The moment that Tank approached Shell dressed as Lord Humongous, that was the first time these two had ever laid eyes on each other. And it was a moment that I stressed about for a month, and don't even ask me how I slept the night before, because if I screwed this up, how could I go on with myself? But the fact that they just shook hands, and I think the very first thing Shell said to you was, "I wanted to wait until I met you to make up my mind about you."
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I thought that was so cool.
Yeah.
And those two hit it off. They have the most wonderful bromance I've ever seen in my life. You should see these two on Facebook. They're adorable. But they're the same person.
We are. We have I'm listening to him tell stories in his very animated sort of way. And, you know, the fish is getting a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger. But I'm going, oh, my God, that's how I tell stories. Holy
yeah.
crap.
We are the same person. Interviewing him was like interviewing Tank.
Mm.
Yeah, it really
lucky.
Was. Yeah. But, yeah, so except for Mel Gibson, I think I have the whole
Come
cast.
On, Mel.
Come on, Mel.
Come on.
Yeah.
You know you want to.
I've got the whole cast of the Road Warrior in my film, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And, you know, you mentioned before that when you first saw Tank, you didn't know anything about the movies. Well, how many times did he make you watch that movie, the whole trilogy?
And I know, and I was just talking about this the other night to my friend, because I was explaining something to my friend about where I was in Australia, and I suddenly had this wealth of information about the film to give him for context of where I was. And I'm like, how did this become my life? How do I know so much about Mad Max?
You got the mungus on you.
So I will say this. I watched the films. I do. I've got a case of the mungus. I watched the films one time each before going to Wasteland. Mm. And turns out I got hosed on Mad Max 1 because I got like the crappy mono dubbed American. And I'm like, I don't get this movie at all. It sucks. I can't understand what anybody's saying. The music is 30 decibels louder than the dialogue. I was getting mad. But then the more I hung out with Tank and his friends, the more insight I got. And the more I realized that this is not just, as I had always kind of assumed, it was like a guy action, like kind of a budget action movie for guys. He introduced me to some of the deeper nuances and the meanings, and all of a sudden I know characters' names and I can tell you the names of cars and all this stuff that
there's gonna be a quiz later. So.
Oh, I'm gonna pass it. So bring it on. Yeah. So the answer is I've probably seen The Road Warrior twice now in my life. But I feel like I've lived it enough that it's okay. I'll watch it again. I've been meaning to watch it since we came back from Australia.
Mm-hmm. Not to sound disappointed or anything.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, going back to the documentary, the content of it itself, Tank, you have quite a portfolio of costumes that you do. Everything from, you know, G.I. Joe characters to, you know, movie characters to, of course, Lord Humongous, which is probably your most famous. Do you have any new characters in the works right now that you can talk about?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it'd be nice to keep a few things still on the surprise possibility. But there's a couple of characters that I've finished and I've worn, you know, once, maybe twice, that I feel haven't gotten like the full light of day. Big Boa from G.I. Joe, the Cobra Trainer, is one that I unveiled at Dragon Con last year that I'd like to bring back and do more with him. I threw together Beef from Phantom of the Paradise, which was really off the beaten path for me because it's a goof, but that's what makes it so much fun, is that I can just be relaxed and be a goof with that one. So those would be cool to do some more. I have a couple that are finished that I'll be unveiling this year at Dragon Con. Actually, one was supposed to be unveiled last year, was Marv from Sin City, along with Lucille, his parole officer. I simply did not have the time or the luggage space to bring him out last year. So that'll be for this year. We've got a Kill Bill group going on. So Faye is doing Beatrix Kiddo.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. I'm now coming back to these things with costumes.
He's converted me.
Yep. You know what? Everybody's so cool, and they all just started, some people just invited me into their groups, and I thought, well, if that isn't the most inclusive and welcoming thing, how could I ever say no? And they have so much fun doing it, so hell yeah, I'll be there.
Yeah, so our Kill Bill group, so we have our Beatrix. My wife, Sasha, will be Ellie Driver. I'm going to do Bud. We've got some crazy 88, so that'll be a fun group. And I just want to, I'm kind of looking forward to, in a weird sort of way, is a guy we've been calling the Germanic Mechanic. A good friend of ours, whom you know, Jared, is a huge Indiana Jones fan, as is Faye. So he got this idea of putting together a little group. Faye got this idea of putting together this group. Probably describe it better than I could.
Get it right, Dorothy.
Yeah, okay, come on. You lay out with this one.
Well, last year at Dragon Con, Tank and Sasha were Conan, and Jared was Indy, and I was just filming. And I thought Jared did a great Indy, and we were getting... It was the first time I'd met Jared, and we were getting along really well. So I told him at dinner, I'm like, listen, if you ever need a Marion or an Elsa or a Willy to your Indy, like, let me know. I'd be down. That'd be fun. Like, that's something I could actually get into, because Indiana Jones, I would say, is my Mad Max. Like, I'm... That's the movie I geek out about the hardest. So he said, yeah, that'd be great. So we're going to do Marion and Indy. We're doing a Raiders one this year, and we're going to do Marion and Indy after the Ark gets open. So we're going to be all singed and dirty and burnt up and bloody. And Tank is going to be who we call the Germanic Mechanic, the guy that Indy fights in that the Nazi base with the airplane, and he gets decapitated by the propeller.
We don't see what happens,
but...
I get a strap like a propeller to my back and just have it spin.
I think we should find somebody who will chase you with a propeller.
I don't know. That's kind of scary.
Hmm.
So those are in the bag. Those are ready to go. If I have the time, I would like to get a new version of Conan done. I've always been partial to the version from Barbarian, where he paints himself up in black and white, sort of camo pattern to break into the tower. I thought that would go over really well. I've been toying with the idea of doing Captain Harlock to go with a friend's Queen Emeraldus. And believe it or not, Martial Law, which is kind of an obscure comic book from the 80s that I've been thinking about doing for ever. And I'm finally starting to look on eBay and piece things together. So we'll see. We'll see if time permits.
That's always the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, time, money, you know, all that good stuff.
So out of all of those, which one's your favorite and why?
Out of this group, there isn't one that I'm strongly emotionally attached to, like, say, Lord Humongous, or get to know that there's a huge crowd response, like Drago. So it's kind of tough to say, but I can say with Martial Law, I actually started that costume probably over 20 years ago. It was the mid-90s. I actually made the hat for the costume with the idea that, you know, maybe one day I'd make the full costume. And of course, we're talking 95. Cosplay wasn't even a word yet. So that's, if that comes to fruition, that'll be kind of like, yeah, I did it. It only took me a couple decades, but damn, I did it. Kind of similar for Captain Harlock, because I've been a fan of that since I was a little kid. And I remember going to Dragon Con when I worked for the Misfits. We used to play there back in the 90s. And I witnessed a costume contest before Dragon Con was what it is today, where everybody's in costume. And there was a young man dressed up as Captain Harlock. I remember being like, oh, wow, that's cool. I like that. I don't know. The biggest crowd reaction would probably be Conan with the black and white camo. But I think the character that I would relate to the most out of all those would be Marv. Because he's my kind of just rough around the edges, tough guy, anti-hero, yet he's still very polite and respectful towards the ladies. And
my kind of guy, too.
That's right. That's right, the perfect man. So, there we go.
What I imagine is probably one of the hardest parts of not only the documentary filming, but also attending conventions and just kind of keeping up with all of this, is having not only being a business owner, but having a family. I mean, I know that you have a supportive wife, Sasha's. I'm friends with both of you on Facebook, and I get to see a lot of the behind the scenes, and I think it's wonderful. But what is what would you say is your secret to balancing all of that?
Plan?
Is there a secret?
Ain't no plan. when I used to tour manage the Misfits, I had a saying that organization was the key to success, and preparedness was next to godliness. Well, I was nowhere near as overwhelmed back then as I am now with the schedule I've got. So all that goes right out the friggin' window. Organization, what the hell is that? You know, it was a few years ago at Wasteland Weekend, a campmate of mine, who's now one of my dogs of war, my good buddy Curtis, mentioned something about my type A-ness. Type A-ness.
Type A-ness.
Let me clarify. My type A-ness. All right, enough with the laughter. Basically saying that I obviously... my personality is such, like you said before, that everything I do is 200%, that I overload my plate just like I'm always, you know, at the buffet. But I tend to work well under pressure. I even knew that, you know, back in the days of working in restaurants and when we get the lunch rush or whatever, and I could just felt like I could get more done if there was stress placed upon me. That also means that, you know, there's plenty of sleepless nights, you know, tossing and turning and worrying about this stuff and waking up early to try and get it done. But I think ultimately there's a clock ticking in the back of my head, and the costumes, the vehicles, the working out, the physique, the whatever, it all has to be done by X date. And if it ain't, you know, I'm not going to be satisfied. I'm not going to be fulfilled. So that ticking clock is almost like a time bomb. That's what keeps me going.
Nice. That makes sense. The documentary itself, you know, I think that the influence that it can have, that you have on other cosplayers, maybe even other Mad Max fans, people who just maybe see you at these conventions and they really appreciate what you do and, you know, this 200% you put into stuff. How do you hope that this documentary influences those people and even the future fans of this genre?
Well, one of the things I struggled with when I was first... I made my first Road Warrior costume in '99, and you knew what the character was, but it wasn't screen accurate. In fact, I was very proud of the costume. I made it for a Misfits Halloween show in L.A., and I was like, yeah, check this out. You know, it's so cool. And then I brought it out to the first Wasteland Weekend, and I was too embarrassed to take it out of the bag because it was so far from screen accurate. But we didn't have the resources back then to network and find out, you know, what did you find out? Where did you get that piece? You know? So until that came about, I thought I was the only one. I thought I was the only maniac out there that was buying up the movie posters and pieces of costume and wanting to dress up like this. Then the internet comes out and Facebook comes out and, you know, the world becomes a much smaller place. And I realized, wow, there's a lot of maniacs out there and they're just like me. This is great. So hopefully this documentary will bring in some of those new fans, especially now that Fury Road came out and there's like a whole new influx of a whole new generation of Mad Max fans going, wait, there's three other Mad Max movies? Holy crap. You know, they came out before I was born. You know, the resources are there. The family, as Faye mentioned before, is there. So hopefully they can see that and realize, okay, there's something I can tap into. There's something I want to be a part of here, a place where I feel like I belong. My greatest joy, I guess you could say, as a cosplayer, typically takes place at Wasteland Weekend when I'm together with all my dogs of war, which are screen accurate, you know, villains and marauders from the Road Warrior. We're there with all of our screen accurate vehicles. We're in the desert. We're in the wasteland. We're recreating some scene from the movie with a huge audience and cameras rolling. And it feels like we're living the movie. That anybody who wants to be a part of that, come see me because we'll get you involved. And it's a bucket list item right there.
Yeah,
definitely.
And to go, I was actually going to mention that Tank mentioned that in one of the interviews I did, that he didn't know he was, he thought he was the only one that was so into this. I would like to comment a little bit on just the way people react to Tank. I've never seen anything like it. I've met, you know, enigmatic or charismatic people in my life, but there's something about Tank. People just are drawn to him, and they come to him and they ask him these really sincere questions in earnest, and they look up to him, and it's just so obvious when you just in the look in their eyes. Tank has something that other people can acknowledge, whether it's subconsciously or not. And I think they inspire whatever Tank has in him, it inspires others. And I think people see the work that Tank puts into this passion. And I think they think, well, yeah, that's, you know, I have a costume, but it could be 10 times better if I changed, you know, X, Y, and Z. Let me just step up my game here, because look at what this guy's doing, and look how cool it is, and look at how successful he is for this. And I think Tank inspires people to step up their game. And I can honestly say that in my own experience, too. Tank inspires me to step up my own game, because this is a hard, challenging, daunting project that I love every second of. But it's just Tank's words of encouragement, or just seeing how dedicated Tank is to it, and how dedicated Tank is to making this Lord Humongous a huge part of his life, that I don't want to stop now. Tank's not stopping now. I'm not going to stop now either. Two men we met in the Outback, Mick and his son Josh, they came out as berserkers, and they remade an old Farlane to be an MSP car, and they're already talking to Tank now on Facebook about how to make their costumes better. You know, Tank inspires people to step up his game, and I think that bringing this movie to a wider audience, a global audience, hopefully it sparks that same kind of enthusiasm and dedication to the audience that it does to people Tank comes across in real life.
The Tank may or may not be blushing right now.
The Tank is crying. But other than that, what I'd like to see happen, I'd like to bring some awareness with this film to the Silverton Collective. It is an amazing event that happens every other year in Silverton, New South Wales. It is phenomenal. The cars, the bikes, the costumes, the people, the experience of being in the Outback for a week. I can't say enough about it. I've been invited back for the next event, not only to just come as a friend, but to show my film at the Broken Hill Theater, which is the theater where Mad Max 2 premiered. I can't say enough good things about the Silverton Collective. If you've never heard of it, find them on Facebook and really start saving your pennies and think about coming over. I can't say enough good things about it. Other than that, you know, Wasteland Weekend, we want to give them a shout out. We love Wasteland Weekend just the way it is right now, but we'd also love to see it grow. So that's a double-edged sword, but we know the film is going to bring a lot of attention to Wasteland, and I hope it's all for the best.
And you were at Wasteland Weekend last year, right, Faye?
Yeah, and I'll be back again this year.
Oh, nice, nice. Are there any special plans that you can talk about that might be different than the normal Lord Humongous speech and everything this year?
The normal Lord Humongous speech.
The abnormal, I guess.
Actually, as of this weekend, we are exactly 6 months out. The unofficial is happening right now, which is the halfway point. At this point, we have a secret Dogs of War Facebook page where we discuss our plans and do all that stuff. So it's a surprise for everyone. The point I'm at right now is, for years now, even before the Dogs of War really became came to the forefront, the Lord Humongous schedule for Wasteland Weekend is absurd. It's like four pages of got to be here, got to be there, got to be somewhere else. Weddings and memorial services and DJ sets and intros and appearances and, you know, shaking babies and kissing hands. And I've gotten overwhelmed and it's gotten almost impossible for me to run the show. So I'm actually at a point where I'm restructuring the inner workings of our Dogs of War tribe, and trying to institute some lieutenants that I can disseminate,
delegate.
Thank you. Delegate you know, tasks down to, and then they'll have people under them. So kind of like a pyramid scheme, you know, if you want to get in now at the ground level, that's great. Just, you know, trying to make things run a bit more smoothly for us internally. So externally, what we do can be so much more. Now, of course, being one of the focal points of Wasteland Weekend as far as photo ops is concerned with our tribe, whenever we do something, we try to do it big, which means we need to have the approval of the event organizers. So anything that we talk about, I need to run by a couple of guys, say, hey, this is what we're thinking. How does this jive with the event schedule? How does it jive with the Wasteland Weekend storyline, so to speak? What safety precautions do we have to take? So there's what we're trying to shoot for is Wasteland Weekend is now a 5-day event. Not counting Sunday, we're looking to do like one major thing each day. It might take 2-3 hours of time, let's say. But it's all, everything's in the planning stages right now, but again, because it has to be run through the upper echelon, the upper management, if you will, to make sure that they can get word out so everybody shows up and sees what we're doing. We're not just doing it for ourselves, although there is some stuff that we'll be doing for ourselves. So it'll be, no matter what, it'll be epic. And Faye hates that word.
I do hate that word. The original plan was to have the film wrapped by Australia. But so many other wonderful things popped up on our schedule that there's just a couple little loose ends that I need to tie up. Nothing major. I am going back to Wasteland to get some more footage. I was so overwhelmed by just focusing on not screwing up at Wasteland that I didn't have as much fun shooting it as I could have, because that was fun as hell. And I mean, I'm hanging off of cars and just riding around on cars where there are no seats for me even, and getting off with like bloody ripped up shirts. And I had a blast. And I don't think to me, the footage doesn't reflect how much fun I had and how much fun it actually is. So I'm going to go back way more laid back, way more experienced, not as nervous. I didn't pack all the gear I wanted to the last time. I was so afraid of overpacking and having it get all dusty and broken and ruined, which happened anyway to the gear I brought. But there was a 7-hour sandstorm the one day that ruined everything. But thanks to the Swede and everybody else who fixed my gear while I pretended I wasn't crying. Yeah. other than that, we've got a couple possible irons in the fire that are really exciting, but we're going to keep under wraps. And I would think that production would probably wrap in October, giving me probably a year afterwards to edit it. I have a couple editors lined up now to possibly do it, and whoever's doing it is doing it out of the kindness of their heart and won't be doing it full time.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So I think that I think a year is probably a really accurate estimation of how long it'll take to edit it. And then we'll take it to Broken Hill, and we have a couple offers in New York to screen it there. So, and Chai Forrest, who runs Hacking Hollywood in LA, he's offered to help us get a red carpet out there. So, you know, a modest red carpet, not like a Grammys red carpet.
Well, hey, wait a minute now. That's what I was hoping for.
But yeah, things are wrapping up. We're just tying up loose ends, and I can't believe I'm saying that. Yeah. This June will be 1 year that we've been shooting, and that's hard to believe as well.
I guess you could still try for stuff like Sundance and kind of
hit that. Good point. Yeah, well, now that we're back from Australia, I have the footage that I've in my head have known that I've wanted since the beginning. So now that I have that footage, I know that I can put together something very short and sweet and to the point, and we can start shopping it around and see if there's any takers for, you know, a production company that wants to bite and put it on some kind of online streaming service, which would be in my mind, the best case scenario. Get it on an online streaming service where you could just log in and watch it. That'd be great. In the meantime, yeah, once it's edited and we get it premiered in Broken Hill and possibly LA and New York, yeah, I'm shopping the hell out of this thing to every film festival that'll accept my entry. Whether or not I think I stand a chance or not, who cares? You don't know till you try. I never thought I was going to quit my job and make a movie and travel the world with a naked guy. So, stranger things have happened.
Oh, my.
That's the quote of the show right there. All right. Well, I wish you both the best of luck. I think that this is such a great idea. It's such an inspirational story, not only from Faye's point of view, but also from, you know, just the whole story itself and how you talked about the influences and the inspiration that it can give, you know, a next generation. It makes it sound old, but a next, you know, the next iteration of cosplayers and Mad Max fans. And like you said, how Tank inspires people to do their best, and I think that's absolutely true. So I'm really excited about the release of this. I'm excited to see. And, you know, I'm hoping to be at Wasteland Weekend this year, so maybe I will be part of that, you know, part of the, this kind of final, you know, see it unfold, the final parts of it. And I think that would be wonderful. Yeah, again, I want to thank you both for being on the show. It was a lot of fun, and I really am looking forward to this one.
Oh.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, buddy. Is it good for you, Sean? Was it good for you?
Was it good for you?